Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for being here. We are in the book of Habakkuk, in the final chapter, looking at what appears to be a theophany, or the appearance of the Lord, and I'll give some more details on it tonight, looking at other scriptures. As we've looked at this, it's kind of the end of Habakkuk's vision. It's his prayer. So chapter 1 and 2 was a vision or information that he received from the Lord. Habakkuk was complaining about his society, about how corrupt it was in Judea, and wanted God to intervene and separate the wicked from those that were, you know, following him. And the answer was, I'm bringing in the Babylonians, and I'm going to destroy the whole culture. And Habakkuk was shocked by that, because it's like, you're going to use those that are more wicked than us to destroy our land. And Habakkuk replied and kind of argued with God, as we've seen, you know, Job do, or Jeremiah, or, you know, Peter arguing with the Lord. And God began to reveal that there's a cycle going through, that, you know, the wicked are going to continue to be destroyed by another group of wicked that are coming as history continues to move towards the ultimate fulfillment. And in the end, there's going to be the ultimate intervention of the Lord. So the Lord is using, you know, the Assyrians, then the Babylonians to overthrow the Assyrians. That's what the book of Nahum was about. Then even in Jeremiah, it's by the third generation, Nebuchadnezzar's grandson will be overthrown by the Persians, who are going to be overthrown by the Greeks. Thus the book of Daniel, the four kingdoms, and then the Romans, and history is just cycling through. And Habakkuk is, in a sense, upset, because, you know, it's like, how long is this? When are you going to fix this? When is it going to be balanced out? And the Lord says, the time is coming. In the future, wait for it. In fact, we can see, if we look very quickly, chapter 2, verse 2, the Lord replied, write down the revelation. And the revelation he's writing down is the answer to Habakkuk's question. And make it plain on tablets, so that a herald may run with it, for the revelation awaits an appointed time. And the revelation is this right here. This is going to continue. This is going to continue. But I will make things right. There will be a day when I will intervene in history and make things right. For the revelation, verse 3, awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end. It will not prove false. Though it linger, and here this is, again, the scary part of it, the concerning part, though it linger, wait for it. Our job is to wait. Just like we saw last night in Revelation, the beast is coming, you know, the first beast, the second beast. And then it says, this calls for patient endurance on the part of the saints. It's going to be ugly. It's going to be difficult. You're going to go through this period. Calls for patient endurance. Though it linger, wait for it. And then it says, though it linger, wait for it. I lost my place. Harold, let me run a point of time. It speaks at the end and it will not prove false. Though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come and will not delay. And so this date is certain. This event is certain. We are waiting for it. We're showing faith. We're showing patience. We're showing endurance in the ability to wait for this moment where God intervenes in history and establishes his kingdom. And what we have then in, and there's several things there, in chapter 3 is finally Habakkuk wraps his mind around, because Habakkuk wanted God to intervene right here and fix his culture. God says, I'm going to fix your culture by bringing the Babylonians and wiping out your culture. But the Babylonians themselves are going to be arrogant, and then they'll be wiped out. And then that culture will be arrogant, and they'll be wiped out, and this is going to continue. And Habakkuk wanted God to intervene right there in that point in history. Now, chapter 3 now, just like look in chapter 1, verse 1, an oracle that Habakkuk the prophet received. Chapter 1, verse 1, the prophet receives an oracle, or the word is burden, or an oracle, a message, the revelation. And that's chapter 1 and 2. Then we go through all that. He struggles with it because it's a revelation. It's new information. It's something that, oh my gosh, this is not what I already had a, you know, when you go to God in prayer, you've got a preconceived, this is what I'm praying about, this is the answer I want, and perfect, God, you agree with me. I got this prayer, I got this answer I'm expecting, and God's answer is, no, we're going to overthrow your culture with the Babylonians. It's like, no, that's not what I want. Same thing Peter did at the Mount of Transfiguration. Jesus comes down and says, I'm going to go to Jerusalem, I'll be handed over, betrayed, and Son of Man will be crucified. It's like, No, that's not at all. No, we've already got this figured out. What you're going to do is set up the kingdom, Lord. It's like, no, I'm going to the cross. It's like, and then he says, get behind me, Satan. And so Habakkuk has heard the message. And that's what's kind of astounding about this is he hears the message and it's not at all what he wanted to hear. So he comes to grips with it. And so in chapter 3, verse 1, we move out of the vision into the response, and here it is. It says, a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet on Sigionoth. And so again, the prophet, but this now is a prayer. And it's written as a poem, it's written as a song, and it's designed, as you can see at the very end of the book, the last verse, for the director of music on my stringed instrument. So it's a genre of music to be sung and played by the congregation in the temple on stringed instruments. Again, you know, like to think of, you know, electric guitars and some loud music, but it's a certain type of song, probably some kind of a lament. So this prayer is a song that's going to be sung to help the people remember this message and be prepared so that they've got a song to sing while they are waiting, while they're enduring. And again, I think this could be very applicable for us today in our culture as Christians waiting for the return of Christ, is the things that are being said here are, again, as I've said it before and we'll look at it and you don't have to agree with it at all, but it is talking about the second coming. It's talking about when the Lord intervenes in history and sets up his kingdom. And it's going to be a theophany. It's going to be the Lord entering into history to take control of history, and in this case, for the final time. But there's been theophanies throughout history, and we've got, I'll read through some of them, and you're going to see a pattern whenever the Lord intervenes in history, if it be at Mount Sinai, if it be with Deborah and Barak, if it be, you know, well, I've got some record of a Revelation. There's going to be a result in the atmosphere, in the universe, in the earth's climate, in its the earthquakes, the islands, the waters. They're going to respond because the Lord is moving into the earth. And so this is probably an account of that, the second coming. But it's taking into thought what took place at Mount Sinai, what it looked like in the book of Judges, what it looks like as recorded in Psalms, what Isaiah prophesies about, and that would be available to Habakkuk, and on into Revelation. And so we begin chapter 3. Again, here it is. Chapter 3, verse 2, Lord, I have heard of your fame, and I stand in awe of your deeds. This is the NIV. O Lord, renew them in our day, in our time make them known, in wrath remember mercy. And again, the English Standard Version makes it a little more clear. Lord, I have heard of your fame, or I've heard your report, meaning I've heard chapter 1 and 2, I've heard the revelation. I stand in awe of your deeds, that is right there, the word fear, I fear, I've heard your report. I stand in awe, or I stand in fear of your works. I've heard your words, the report. I understand the work you're about to do in my country, which is destroy the land of Judea. And I stand in fear. Then he says, renew them on our day, or in our time make them known, in wrath remember mercy. Three things. The word renew is the word in this time period, in this time of the judgment of Judah, until you restore Israel and bring your kingdom to the earth, we need renewed. We need life. And then make it known. Make what known? Make this report known. That people, when they're going through this dark period between all this cycling of cultures and nations as we're heading towards the second coming, make this revelation known. And then three, in wrath, remember mercy. Because this is going to culminate in the wrath of God, and God is moving. Romans chapter 1, His wrath is being revealed to mankind throughout history, looking for this day, leading men towards this. But during this, during history and in the end, when the wrath of God is poured out, remember mercy. So, we've heard the words, we know the works He's going to do. It causes fear on what's to transpire in the earth. Keep us alive, renew us, new birth, bring us some life. Make this known that we don't take our eye off your word so we understand what is happening in history. And remember, as we're going through all of this, to remember mercy. And that, in a sense, would be the prayer that he is praying. And then begins verse 3, begins the theophany. We talked about this last week. Verse 3, God came from Teman, the Holy One from Mount Paran. And just right in there, the word God is an ancient word for God. It's used especially in the book of Job. Came from Teman. This begins right away of this. Here's the Dead Sea. Galilee is up here. Jerusalem. But now we're down here in Edom. Mount Sinai is down here. And what you see is God progressing from Mount Paran, Mount Sinai from the south, and he's progressing towards Jerusalem. And this is the journey, you know, in a rough sense, the journey of the Exodus, but it's also the journey he's going to be making to bring judgment now on Jerusalem. That's what the book is about. It's written the same time as Jeremiah. So Jeremiah, Habakkuk, and Zephaniah are all saying the same message. Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. Nebuchadnezzar is coming. And so this is talking about remembering the Exodus. Also, this is what God is going to be doing. But also, we have the same journey in the book of Revelation when the Lord, or Isaiah 63, we looked at that last week, Isaiah 63, beginning in verse 1, where who is this striding forth in great power and might coming from Edom or Bozra? It's the Lord, mighty in power, coming to save. He's judged the nations in Isaiah 63, and this ties into Revelation with 144,000 being sealed and hidden in the wilderness. As Jesus says, when you see these things take place in Jerusalem, flee to the mountains. And so it's talking about the Exodus. It's talking about the events that are going to transpire in Jeremiah, Habakkuk, Zephaniah's day, and it looking forward to the day when the Lord returns and comes up from Bozrah, possibly with the 144,000. And so that's what that verse is about, the Holy One from Mount Paran. And then it says, His glory covered the heavens and His praise filled the earth. And that this is now the beginning of the theophany, or the beginning of the Lord in intervening or coming into or manifesting into nature, into the physical world. Not just being far away in heaven, but actually crossing over and entering into our dimension. And whenever that happens, the same things transpire. That's kind of what we're going to see tonight. The glory covered the heavens, meaning the atmosphere was covered, and His praise filled the earth. The result of His coming filled the earth. Now, verse 4, this is the new material for tonight. I'm reading in the NIV. His splendor was like the sunrise, rays flashed from His hand, where His power was hidden. It's interesting right there. You can see light, but that light is merely a manifestation of what is actually hidden yet behind. There's much more. You're seeing the light. You're seeing this, but his character, His presence is hidden yet. Which, again, is both a manifestation, but also a protective measure. Remember Moses on Mount Sinai wanting to see God. And God says, well, I'll pass before, and all that what he saw, you know, ended up being just a still, quiet voice. He says, you can't see my face. Now it says, verse 5, plague went before him, pestilence followed his steps. We'll talk about that. He stood and shook the earth. He looked and made the nations tremble. The ancient mountains crumbled. This is an important line. The ancient mountains crumbled. The age-old hills collapsed. His ways are eternal. I saw the tents of Cushan in distress and the dwellings of Midian in anguish. And whatever you have, basically whatever you have, a theophany of God entering into the world, entering into our physical universe, you're going to have some kind of manifestation of, you know, earthquakes and shaking and terrifying things. But then also the nations are always in jeopardy. The nations, whenever God intervenes, there's always the nations that are, in a sense, in his place of his coming kingdom. They're always the ones that are in danger. Thus, the Cushion and Midian are mentioned. And then we'll pick up verse 8 next week. Were you angry with the rivers? Was your wrath against the streams? Did you rage against the sea? Because when he comes into the atmosphere, into the earth, or theophany, the earth changes. The shaking, the waters, it's like, are you angry with nature? Why is nature always revolting? Not in a revolution, but, you know, what's a better word for that? Just going into chaos because he comes in. It's like, no, if he's angry with anything, then it's going to be the nations. And again, this is, again, a capturing of the hope that Habakkuk, this is what Habakkuk wanted in the beginning. He says, you know, how long are you going to put up with this Hamas in our society? Will you come and do something about it? God says, not yet. Before I come, I'm bringing the Babylonians to do my work. It's like the Babylonians, we just want you to come and set up your kingdom and get this going. No, I'm bringing the Babylonians in. And even Habakkuk says, well, they're wicked. He said, then God goes on and says, yeah, but their own arrogance will lead them to destruction. You can't live like the Babylonians and survive. They're going to do my work and then they'll burn themselves out and I'll bring someone else in. And this is really what we all are looking for. We're not looking for the Persians to deliver us from the Babylonians or the Greeks to deliver us from the Persians. We're looking for the manifestation of the Son of God to set up his kingdom. But until that time, God is using history to put these things together. Now, on your notes, I've just got page 3 and 4. This is, you know, added on to from last week. This is the English Standard Version, and I'll read through the bold print on 3 and 4. And this is what we're looking at. If I can use the word theophany, it's the coming of the Lord. A theophany is where God, ophany, epiphany, manifests, a manifestation of God in nature. We would call it the second coming. That would be a theophany. Anytime God shows up, it could even be something simple like the Lord appearing and talking to Abraham. That doesn't fall in the same type of a theophany that we're looking at here. But when the Lord appears in history and is visible. Anyway, his brightness, chapter 3, verse 4, top of page 3, his brightness was like the light. Rays flashed from his hand, and there he veiled his power. The idea there, again, here's this light coming from him, but all you see is the light, but you know there's something more there than just this light, but that light is concealing the power, his character, his face. And then it says, before him went pestilence and plague followed his heels. So as he's manifesting, the manifestation of his light causes pestilence. And then after he's moved through, following behind is plague followed his heels. And we'll talk a little bit about that. And then on page 4, chapter 3, verse 6, he stood and measured the earth. He looked and shook the nations. Again, measuring is kind of analyzing, taking measurements. What are his plans for it? He looked and shook the nations. That would be some kind of removal, some kind of judgment of the nations as he's getting ready to set up his own kingdom. Then the eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. And that always takes place. And I've got a list right here. We're going to come back and look at those, read through different theophanies. And anytime this happens, you know, when it talks about the mountains disappeared, the islands disappeared, the waters were in turmoil, the tsunamis taking place, you can figuratively make that a metaphor. Like the mountains often refer to kingdoms, and so when the mountains fall, that could mean all the nations, the kingdoms fell. or the government, the leadership of the government. If the mountain of Babylon falls, that means the governmental leadership of Babylon collapses. That can be a figurative way of seeing this. But when we look and compare it to other things and actual occurrences on Mount Sinai, when he appears on Mount Sinai, there's no governments falling. It's actually fire and smoke and manifestation. And we'll see others. And you can make your own decision. It can be poetic or it can be, you know, literal. And again, it's a prayer written in a song. So keep this in mind. The eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. And then his ways are everlasting, or his were the everlasting ways. Then chapter 3, verse 7, I saw the tent. When this happens, the tents of Cushan in affliction, the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. When the nations see the Lord coming in, it's like they realize their time is over. We see that in, and we're looking at the sixth seal again, the nations realize it. And I go to Psalm chapter 2 very quickly. And read the opening verses there, because this is the ultimate fate of the earth. Chapter 2 of Psalm. David writes, why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth take their stand, the rulers gather together. So the nations are conspiring, the people are plotting, the kings are taking their stand, the rulers are gathering together. They've got their plan, but they're coming against, and this is history in a nutshell. And you're going to have good cultures and good nations rise up, good leaders rise up. But as a whole, the nations are a temporary fix, a replacement for the Lord. And oftentimes, especially with the rulers and authorities in heavenly places, the kingdoms of this earth are used in a direct rebellion against, well, right here. Why do the rulers gather together? Against Yahweh and against his anointed one, right there, the Father and the Son. Why are the nations, why do they not merely submit to him? Why do they take this opportunity to try to rebel against him and take what is actually his and make it their own? They say, verse 3, let us break their chains, they say, and throw off their fetters. Now that is the kings, the rulers, the nations, the people conspiring and looking at Yahweh and his anointed one, saying, you have put us in chains and put us in fetters. You've locked us in. And yeah, they have. They have locked us in. They've the God eternal and his eternal son have, in a sense, put mankind in chains. But what kind of chains? It's reality. I mean, we live in reality. You can't change time. You can't change history. You can't. This is you live in a body. I mean, it's like, let's change these. Let's make our own reality. I mean, you see it going on in our culture now. They want to throw off the fetters and the chains. Like they're only chains and fetters if you're in rebellion towards the Lord. But if you're walking with the Lord in his reality, it's a blessing. He's created institutions for us to follow. But when you want to go into rebellion, well, these institutions are they're chains. Well, anyway. Verse 4, and I mean, that's human history, trying to change God's reality. The one enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord scoffs at them. It's like, you can't change anything. Then he rebukes them in his anger and terrifies them in his wrath, saying, I have installed my king on Zion, my holy hill. I've already determined who's going to rule these nations. I've already established the reality through the Creator, the Son, Jesus Christ. I will proclaim the decree of the Lord. And it goes on and he talks some other things there. We studied that in Hebrews. And then verse 10, therefore, you kings, this is David writing, therefore, you kings, be wise, you rulers of the earth, be warned. Serve the Lord with fear. If you find yourself in a leadership position, understand you are in God's reality. Fear the Lord and follow him and don't try to rebel against him. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Good advice right here. Kiss the Son, mean pay homage to the Son, the rightful king. If you are a king today, pay homage to the rightful king, lest he be angry. And here it is. unless he be angry and you be destroyed in your way, for his wrath can flare up in a moment. And that is what we're waiting for, is the wrath of the Lamb is going to be coming to the nations. So the nations are warned. This is your fate. You either live in time in submission to the Son and Yahweh, or you try to create your own reality and call them the enemy and rebel. But eventually his wrath is coming. Romans, the whole book begins with that. And then blessed are all who take refuge in him. So let's go back to the notes and see on page 3, the first page, I guess. Just I'm going to read through these notes and then read some more scripture. It says his brightness was like the light, rays flashed from his hand. And the brightness or radiance was like light. So that's what, I got my little diagram right here. You're seeing the light. And rays flashed, or he had rays flashing, comes from the word which means a horn. And that's where, if you want to know a little bit about art history, Moses, this word is also used as light radiating from Moses' face. Obviously, they're not talking about horns, but like rays of light can look like horns. And so that's the word used in the Hebrew. It can be translated horns. These aren't horns. They're like rays of light. And in the older translations, when a lot of artwork was being done, Michelangelo and stuff, the text said horns. I think it would probably be, I'm guessing it would be the Latin Vulgate. It said horns. And so that's why you have pictures of Moses after he'd been with God. They actually have horns. I mean, they actually have horns on in his head. And our modern translation, well, they weren't horns. They were like rays of light, like horns of light coming out. And so you just interest. That's an interesting point. If you ever see a statue of Moses, like, I don't know where, if at the Vatican or wherever, you'll see little horns. And it's kind of like, what the heck? Well, he had horns coming out of his face, out of his head, after he'd been with the Lord. Horn, I don't remember that. Well, no, because the translation we have is light radiating from his face. But anyway, it's the same word right here. That's trivial information if you ever have an art quiz. But the rest of his power is veiled or hidden. And that's exactly what it means. Veiled or hidden is from the word meaning hiding or in a hiding place. And so his strength, his might, you're just seeing the light coming, but there's more power there that will eventually manifest. That's what this verse is saying. Now, I'm going to go right here, because I've got it written down, I don't want to forget. I'm going to go to Exodus chapter 20. And we're going to read several accounts of this. I'm interested in it. Exodus chapter 20. To justify what I am saying about this chapter. And it's not a lot of argument or debate about chapter 3. But the easy way out of this is just to say, oh, Habakkuk is recounting God's manifestation to the Jewish people on Mount Sinai, and he's in a sense poetically recounting a historical event. I don't think so, because he's got chapter 1 and 2 of fresh revelation, and he's frustrated with God's answer that God is not going to intervene in history right then and there, but is going to use the Babylonians to intervene, and after them the Persians, and he wants God to come and do something now and fix the problem. And so he's not just going to bail out. He could. You think about it yourself. He's not just going to look back. Oh, yeah, I remember the good old days. Because the vision is for the end. He even says it's in the end. You have to wait for it. And what he's waiting for is God to come, the Lord to come. And so what he's going to do, I think, in this chapter 3 is look at all and remember all the theophanies and kind of get a big picture. This is what the second coming will be like. Without revelation, without anything in the New Testament, he's looking to this event of when the Lord comes into history, comes back, sets up his kingdom. But it's going to be like all these other times God has made an appearance to correct or do some kind of intervention in history. It's going to be like that, and that's the day he's looking for. So I think this is more of a collection. So here's one of the references, chapter 20 of Exodus, verse 14. oh my gosh, this is not right. That's the middle of the Ten Commandments. What did I do wrong? Lord of... Okay, I'll have to figure this out. I'm going to go back to chapter 19. I caught it. Okay. Sometimes I can't make a recovery. Chapter Exodus 20 should be Exodus 19. And so here it is, chapter 20, beginning in verse 14. Okay, now listen, I included this verse in what I'm going to read, verse 14, to explain this. Because for years, I did not understand why this was here. Because they're getting ready to meet the Lord at Mount Sinai. And he's going to say something about sexual relations. And it's kind of like, what? And it's like, and I since, you know, years ago, I've learned something about this, not about sexual relations, but about what this verse means. Here we go. Chapter 19, verse 14. After Moses had gone down the mountain to the people, he consecrated them and they washed their clothes. Then he said to the people, prepare yourselves for the third day, meaning in 3 days we're going to meet with the Lord. And then he says, abstain from sexual relations. And then right away your evangelical Protestant mind goes, oh, yeah, because sex is bad, sex is dirty, sex defiles you. It's like, no. I mean, maybe. But when you study Egyptian religions, and I read a book about Hatshepsut. It was one of the great scholars, a lady wrote a book about Hatshepsut, and in there it talked about all the things she did as the queen, or she even was a king for a while. But one of the things as the queen, she was the priest. She was a priestess, was to serve the gods. And I mean, I don't want to go into a lot of detail about it, but I could. There's things, but. It involved sexual activity. It involved many of the, I mean, pagan religion involves sexual relations with the priestess, with the gods, with whatever. There was some sexual activity involved in it. And coming out, and it was normal. I mean, you know, as a Christian, you'd be like, oh, that doesn't even make sense. Well, as a pagan, it made complete sense. You see it, you know, Aphrodite, you see it all the way through the Babylonian gods. There was always sexual relations involved. And so coming out of Egypt, Moses being trained in all the wisdom of Egypt, these people having come out of the pagan religion, I think when it says abstain from sexual relations before they're going to meet God, Moses, probably through God's direction, is going to remove sexuality from religion. As there's no sexual relations going on within 3 days. It's not because it's bad. It's because don't get confused. Don't get this. Don't paganize this relationship with the Lord. Because, again, God created sex. Sex is good. But right here, it's like, no, we're not even there's. You're not going to be able to look back and have any kind of connection. In fact, when they became when they went with the Canaanites, sexual relations became very prominent. I mean, they would have, don't want to go into the details of it, but the Canaanite religions that they picked up involved all kinds of corruption. There was temple priests, prostitutes that would be even in Israel. But anyway, that's what that verse is about. I just want to point that out. Abstain from sexual relations. I think that is to eliminate any connection to the pagan religions. Now, anyway, verse 16, back to what we're looking at. On the morning of the third day, now we're 3 days ahead, here it is, there was thunder and lightning with a thick cloud over the mountain and a very loud trumpet blast. Everyone in the camp trembled. Now this is the Lord coming to meet his people that he just set free. And he's not coming down, you know, riding a lamb, you know, and throwing flowers. He's coming down like this because this is when the Lord enters creation. This is what it looks like. He's gracious. He's merciful. But this is him, his holiness entering into our world. And everyone saw this. Everyone in the camp trembled. Then Moses led the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the foot of the mountain. Mount Sinai was covered with smoke because the Lord descended on it in fire. So now the Lord, he's actually on Mount Sinai. He comes, there's fire. The smoke billowed up from it like smoke from a furnace. The whole mountain trembled violently. There it is. He is on the mountain and it's shaking. It's trembling. Now, this makes sense when you read like his feet in Zechariah, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. In that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives and the mountain will be split in two. It's like, oh, what's that? That's basic history. That's when the Lord stands on the earth. It shakes and splits. The whole mountain trembled violently, and the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder. Then Moses spoke, and the voice of God answered him. The Lord descended to the top of Mount Sinai and called Moses to the top of the mountain. So Moses went up, and the Lord said to him, go down and warn the people. Now watch this. Go down and warn the people so they do not force their way through to see the Lord, and many of them perish. Now, first of all, they're too terrified to even get close. But the Lord says, if they decide to come up and get autographs or something, we're just going to have a bunch of dead people on the side of the mountain. Tell them they can't come any closer. Even the priests who approach the Lord must consecrate themselves, or the Lord, or Yahweh, will break out against them. Moses said to the Lord, the people cannot come up the Mount Sinai because you yourself warned us already. Put limits around the mountain and set it apart. So there's were posts set up before this day came during those 3 days of preparation. They put up little signs, you know, stone monuments. Stop. Don't come any closer. The Lord replied, go down and bring Aaron up. And then that's the main thing there. That's that theophany. I wanted to read that right there. Now, back to the notes, bottom of page 3, chapter 3, verse 5. Before him went pestilence and plague followed at his heels. Now, what we have here is this right here, the light, the rays of light radiating from him. And before him is going to be pestilence. And after he's gone by, plague will follow at his heels. I write down point one, as the Lord moves through the earth, manifested as light rays, His presence burns up what is before him as a pestilence, and pestilence is from Debir, that means pestilence, and leaves charred remains. Charged, I think spelled correct, or they fixed that word for me. It's supposed to be left charred remains behind him as he moved through. So as he's moving, it's destroying and leaving behind this trail of disaster. It is possible these are a result of his holiness. Why would God do that? Well, because, again, this is a fallen world. This is under Satan's control. There is sin. Creation waits for the day when the sons of God to be revealed so nature can be restored to God. So even nature itself is waiting for this day. But until that day, when he appears, it could just be his holiness just causes devastation. Another thing that could be here is anytime a powerful individual in the near ancient East would go somewhere, they would never go alone. They would have like a shield bearer or an armor bearer in front of them, and then their servants would follow them. So when they would go somewhere, there'd be someone out in front of them, and then be servants following behind. And that could simply be the idea here, is his shield bearer, the pestilence, is going in front, and his servants, the plague, is following behind. But nonetheless, he is where he goes, he's wrecking havoc in the earth. And why do you long for the day of the Lord? Is it Joel? I don't remember. I'll think of it in a minute. But they ask, why do you long for the day of the Lord? It's Joel, I think. It is a day of dark. People say, oh, I can't wait for the day of the Lord, the day of the Lord. It's like, no, he says, why? He says, it is going to be a day of judgment and darkness. It's not going to be a glorious day. Now, on the flip side, you know, welcome into my kingdom, right? But to get to that part, well, that's why we go through the book of Revelation. Now, next, chapter 3, verse 6. He stood and measured the earth. Now he's on the earth, and now he's measuring, maybe claiming it as territory. If you measure something, you're planning on doing something with it. The idea also could be he's scoping it out. He's above the earth or on the earth and kind of scoping it out. He looked and shook the nations. So, again, this nations is always going to be in this right here. When he enters into the world, there's going to be catastrophic events. He's measuring it like it's going to be his own. And the nations are shaken. It's like, uh-oh, we're in trouble. Now, again, this is the day. This is, see how this is different than the Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai is involved in this, but he's doing more than just taking the people through the wilderness into the promised land. He's looking at the nations. He's setting up his kingdom. Then the eternal mountains were scattered. I'm sorry. The everlasting hills sank low. Now, you're going to see this in those verses I've got written down right below that. We're going to try to rush through those. It happens almost every time. The mountains sink. The mountains shake. The islands disappear. The continental plates are moving. You can go poetic on this if you want to, but you can't stay poetic because Zechariah, Isaiah says, Jerusalem will be lifted high. And when the Lord returns, Jerusalem will be lifted higher than any of the other mountains on the earth. Zechariah talks about Jerusalem being lifted up, Mount of Olives being split, and the whole land going flat. I mean, Ezekiel, when he sees into the future, he sees Jerusalem on a mountain. There's waterways being created. So it can be poetic, but when the Lord returns, there is going to be movement of the continental plates, rivers being created, nations being reformed. I mean, he's going to reform the earth to some extent. And so, once again, when it says eternal mountains were scattered, you can try to get figurative, and you should consider that. But at the same time, I know it's literal from other references. The everlasting hills sank low. His were the everlasting ways. Okay, I want to do this because I'm excited about this. I'm going to go to Judges chapter 5. And this is kind of the justification of my approach to this chapter. That Habakkuk is looking to the future and anticipating the Lord returning or, you know, coming to set up his kingdom. Because this is what he's seen in all these scriptures except for Zechariah and Revelation, of course, were available. All these things were already written when Habakkuk is writing. So Judges chapter 5. Now, this is great right here. I could get stuck in chapter 5 because this is crazy stuff. Because you're talking about a culture that has gone so dark that they don't know what's wrong. Chapter 5, verse 1. Now, remember the story? This is Deborah and Barak. Deborah tells Barak to go to battle, to fight the Midianites. That God is going to bring. She's a prophetess. And she tells Barak to go, and Barak says, "No, not unless you go with me." I mean, he's a coward. And what you're going to see here is you have got, and I'm going to read through this, and you be the judge, and you correct me, and you think what you want to think. But this is a culture that has got all the institutions completely upside down. They're confused. Barak represents the men in this culture, and they're cowards. They're cowards. They've completely given up to the rule of the nations around them. Deborah has risen up because she's going to say in this song, watch this. Well, I'm going to jump into verse 7. Chapter 5, verse 7. Village life in Israel ceased. Meaning, village, your typical village life. I mean, the family, business, travelers, children playing in the streets. It's gone. It ended because culture got so corrupted, so upside down. It ceased. And then he says, until I, Deborah, arose a mother in Israel. In other words, this society was completely in the dumps. Everything was, the men were cowards. There's no leadership. Families are in disorder until finally a mother. I mean, she's not saying, you know, women are equal with men. She's not saying women can be leaders, too. She's saying it got to the point where there was no only thing left is a mom's got to do this. A mom's got to go out until I, Deborah, a mother in Israel says, I'll take charge. It wasn't like, well, I can do it too. It's like, well, I'm going to do it because no one else is doing it. And then that sets the whole stage up, I think, because she's going to go to, I'm way off. See, I told you, this chapter is loaded. I'm talking about the theophany in here. But she goes, you know the story. She goes to Barak and says, go do this. God says he'll give you deliverance. He says, I ain't going to go unless you go with me. And she curses him, basically. He says, okay, because you're afraid to go, you're going to miss the victory. And instead, a woman will get the victory. That's where the king he's pursuing flees to a tent, and a Jael drives a tent peg through his skull. That's another great children's story. You know the story, right? I mean, yeah, right there. Verse 21 of chapter 4, but Jael, Heber's wife, picked up a tent peg and a hammer and went quietly to him while he lay fast asleep, exhausted. She drove the peg through his temple into the ground, and he died. So he's asleep, and she did. And again, women would set up the tents. And so her using a wooden mallet and a tent stake was the woman's part of their job. And so when he goes asleep, she just grabs a mallet and a tent peg, and you just put it around his head, boom, and one, it's like, wow, how many times do you have to hit it? Probably once. I mean, driving it through a guy's skull is one thing compared. She's used to driving into the ground, rocks and stuff. Now watch, in verse 22, Barak came by in pursuit of Sisera, that's the general, and Jael went out to meet him. Come, she says, I'll show you the man you're looking for. In other words, he could have had the victory if he would have been obedient, but he's not going to go unless Deborah goes. I mean, I don't even trust your prophecy. If you're so confident, you go. She says, well, I trust you. She says, but I can tell you right now, God's not going to give you the victory. A woman's going to get the victory. And Jael killed the general that Sisera's been buried. Okay, nonetheless. Okay. Chapter 5, verse 1. On that day, Deborah and Barak, son of Abinoam, sang this song. Here's another song. When the princes of Israel take the lead, when the people willingly offer themselves, praise the Lord. So right there, finally, when the princes take the lead, when you get out and do what you're supposed to do, and the people offer themselves to the Lord to do what his will is, there's praise. Praise the Lord. Hear this, you kings. Listen, you rulers. Sounds like Psalm chapter 1 or Psalm chapter 2. I will sing to the Lord. I will sing. I'll make music to the Lord, the God of Israel. And this is loaded with information about what was going wrong with their culture. And again, a lot of times they put these things into song so you don't make the same mistake again, or you remember what the Lord has promised that he will do. These songs were not just, you know, the top 40. They were songs of instruction. Now, I'm sure they had their top 40. We know of a top 40 in David's life. When the women came in singing, you know, Saul has slain his thousands, but David's slain his tens of thousands. That was one of the top chart hits. Everybody's singing in the streets. In fact, Saul heard it on the radio and goes, what's this garbage? And they got jealous. That wasn't necessarily a song of remembrance. That was just a song of, you know, a contemporary hit song. This would be a song they'd want them to remember. Nonetheless, chapter 5, verse 4. O Lord, when you went out from Seir, when you marched from the land of Edom, does that sound familiar? Seir is down here. Edom is down here, south of the Dead Sea. It's like, there. She's not talking about, it's the same direction as he came from Mount Sinai. It's the same thing we see in chapter 3 of Habakkuk. It's the same thing we see in Isaiah 63. It's the same thing we see in Revelation. But all of those are 1, 2, 3, 4 different occasions in biblical history is the Lord coming up through Edom to deliver his people. So she says, when you went out from Seir, and I think you're making a mistake. You say, oh, she's remembering the Exodus. No, I think she knows where the Lord is coming from. The earth shook, the heavens poured, the clouds poured down water. If you remember in the battle, that's what defeated the Canaanite chariots. They got in the Jezreel Valley and it rained and their chariots stuck and they couldn't get away. So they got all these powerful weaponry, but once they're in the mud, there's nothing they can do. And so God came from Seir, he came up from Edom to fight in northern Israel in the Jezreel Valley, where the Battle of Armageddon will take place. I mean, something similar. This may be a clue. We've all, you know, been talking about that on two Monday nights. Is how do you reconcile Isaiah 63 where the Lord comes from Bozra with his garments stained with blood, having defeated the nations, up to here, the valley of Armageddon, Harmagedo, valley of Jezreel, where Armageddon's taking place. And then you've got the battle for Jerusalem. He comes here and the battle's fought in Jezreel. So there, that's a correlation from what we're talking about on. I've been talking about that, asking that question for like 5 weeks. I just learned something there. Nonetheless, you marched from the land of Edom. The earth shook. The heavens poured. The clouds poured down their water. The mountains quaked before the Lord, the one of Sinai. Now, again, he's the one who came from Sinai before the Lord, the God of Israel. Now it goes back and talks about what the culture was like. That's the theophany. I just talked about the mountain shaking, the God intervening in history. Verse 6, in the days of Shamgar, son of Anath, in the days of Jael, the roads were abandoned. Meaning the judges before Deborah, they lost control of society and no one could travel on the roads were abandoned. No one was traveling. Travelers took winding paths. In other words, instead of going down the interstate where everybody heavy traffic was there looking for the bandits and the corruption, they would take winding paths. You take all the county roads, the gravel roads, and try and sneak through the country where no one would find you. Village life in Israel ceased. So there's no travel, there's no trade, there's no village life until I, Deborah, arose a mother in Israel. When they chose new gods, war came to the city gates. They chose, instead of following the Lord, they changed reality. They stopped following truth, in a sense, philosophy. They found false gods or a false philosophy, created a false reality. And once they did that, war came right up to the city gates. That's where the city gates, not just the entrance to the city, but that's where the judges sat. That's where court sat. That's where the law and order came into the city, was from the city gates. That's where they would meet. And you can still see the benches in many of the ancient cities. And not a shield or spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. Do you know what that means? There's 40,000 available military age men in Israel, and of 40,000, there's no spears and no shields. Here's your military. Where's your weapons? We don't have any. We don't believe in it. We've got a new philosophy. It's like, you're what? What? It's like, and that's why, it's like, what? Finally, a mother rises up and says, this is crazy. Well, no, we're peaceful people. It's like you're being overrun by the Canaanites. Not a shield or spear was seen among 40,000 in Israel. My heart is with Israel's princes, with their willing volunteers among the people. Praise the Lord. In her day, she changed. She got Barak to go to war. They rose up and they finally had enough. You who ride in on the, I could go through this right here. You who ride on, this is not what I'm talking about. You who ride on the white donkeys, that's the rich people, sitting on your saddled blankets, that would be carpets, that they're riding on, and you who walk along the road, that's the poor people. So you got the people on the race, the white donkeys, those would be like the specially bred, like Absalom, David's son, rode on a mule. It was like one of the race cars. I mean, I wouldn't think of it. What? A donkey? It's a specially bred hybrid race donkey. And that's what that, and they're the rich. And you who walk along the road, consider the voice of the singers at the watering places. Where do the rich and the poor have to go every day? They've got to go down and get water. They didn't have indoor plumbing. They had to go to the watering place. The community would meet there, and that is where you would find the preachers and the prophets. And if you got a new song, I want everybody to hear my new song, you go down there, and that's where you have your street performers, and they'd be singing the song. So you go, consider the voice of the singers at the water place. They recite the righteous acts of the Lord. In other words, the songs they're singing are possibly the old songs from the days of Moses, the days of Abraham, and reciting his righteous deeds, his righteous acts, the righteous acts of his warriors in Israel. So they're singing about the Lord and his righteous acts, but also about the mighty warriors and their righteous acts as they followed the Lord. That's what they're singing. When you go to the water well, listen to the songs. They're singing about God and they're singing about the people that followed him. Then the people of the Lord went down to the city gates. Wake up, Deborah, wake up and break out in song. And they go through, and I could keep going right here. And it tells through all the tribes and what they did. Okay, that's enough of that. Psalm 68. That was more than what I wanted, but that's just sitting right there. And it's just, it's a pretty cool little song, I think. Psalm 68. We're looking at theophany. We're looking at the Lord appearing in history. And I've got to check the time because I have that spider sense tingling feeling. Yep. Psalm 68. May God arise. May his enemies be scattered. May his foes flee before him. Watch. As smoke is blown away by the wind, may you blow them away. As wax melts before the fire, may the wicked perish before their God. But may the righteous be glad and rejoice before God. May they be happy and joyful. Sing to God. And goes through and talks about all that he's doing there. Verse 7. When you went out before your people, O God, when you marched through the wasteland. Now, again, the wasteland, that's all it says is wasteland. But that would be the desert. That would be, here's the Dead Sea, here's Edom. And the wasteland would be this area right here that they came through. So that's a connection of him coming from the south. When you went out before your people, O God, when you marched through the wasteland, the earth shook, the heavens poured down rain before God, the one of Sinai, before God, the God of Israel. You gave abundant showers, O God. You refreshed your weary inheritance. Your people settled in it. And there it is again, a manifestation. Isaiah 64. Now, Isaiah 64, I must make it obvious, comes after Isaiah 63. But in Isaiah 63 is where we see, again, we talked about this last week. Isaiah 53 is where you see the suffering servant. He had no glory. He has no glory and no majesty that would attract us to him. Meaning he's Jesus. He's come as the sacrifice. But Isaiah 63, just 10 chapters later, here we go. We read this last week. Who is this coming from Edom, from Bozrah, with his garment stained crimson? Coming right up from here. Who is this? With his garments, he's got blood all over his garments. Who is this robed in splendor? Here it says, that's the word glory. Where here, he had no glory or no majesty. The word there could be translated, he had no splendor. And he ends up being sacrificed. He was marred beyond human description. He didn't look like a human. He was so beat up. I mean, his own blood was shed. 10 verses later, instead of having no glory, who is this coming in glory or splendor? And you got blood all over your garments. Well, it's not the blood of Isaiah 53. It's the blood of the nations. Who is this robed in splendor striding forward in the greatness of his strength? The answer, it is I, speaking in righteousness, mighty to save. Why are your garments red like those of one treading the winepress? Well, I've trodden the winepress alone. From the nations, no one was with me. When crunch time came, none of the nations were on my side. And so I trampled them in my anger. I trod them down in my wrath. There's that word wrath. The day of wrath is coming. Their blood splattered on my garments, and I stained all my clothing. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and the year of my redemption has come. And it goes through. That is part of how that fits in with, and I'm still trying to put that together, how that fits in with Revelation 19, where the rider on the white horse, Zechariah 14, where the Lord's feet stand on the Mount of Olives, with the Battle of Armageddon, with the Valley of Jehoshaphat, the Valley of Judgment, the Valley of Decision, just east of Jerusalem. These all somehow fit together, but not necessarily exactly the same point. There's a sequence in there that I'm working on. Nonetheless, we are looking, that was chapter 63. I want to go to chapter 64. So this just follows right after 63, right into 64. So we're at that second coming. This chapter 63 is him coming out of Edom. Now 64. Oh, that you would rend the heavens and come down, that the mountains would tremble. Now Isaiah is asking, oh, only if you would just open the heavens and just come down to the earth and get this over with. I mean, the prophets want the second coming. I mean, you understand. the prophets, I mean, they were righteous men, they were faithful men, but they were looking, even Peter says, they were looking in, Peter says, they were looking in and trying to figure out the time of the coming of the Lord. Isaiah wanted the Lord to come back. We can fix this if you'll come back in his day. Jeremiah, we could fix this if you'd come back. Habakkuk, if you'd come back, we could fix this. Today, if you'd come back, we could fix this. But we're waiting. So, Isaiah says, oh, that you would rend the heavens and come down, that the mountains would tremble before you. See, when the mountains start trembling, that's what, yeah, we've got something happening. The Lord's on his way. As when fire sets twigs ablaze and causes water to boil, come down to make your name known to your enemies. They don't even think you exist. Come down and tell you are God. And cause the nations to quake before you. Once again, whenever the Lord comes down, he reveals himself, the mountains quake, and the nations are like, oh no, because they did not submit. Cause the nations to quake before you, for when you did awesome things that we did not expect, you came down and the mountains trembled before you. When you did come down, the mountains were, if it was Mount Sinai, if it was in Deborah's day, since ancient times, no one has heard, no ear has perceived, no eye has seen any God besides you who acts on behalf of those who wait for him. And he goes on and we could keep going there. Nahum chapter 1, I'm going to have to quit here. I'm just going to go to Zechariah 14. I'll quit with Zechariah 14. Zechariah 14. And I have to pick this up next week, generally. Those Revelation verses are just, and you know what they are. Those are, the Revelation 6 is the sixth seal where the Lord appears in the atmosphere and the nations see him and they say, hide us from him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. And they all go run and hide in caves. It is apparently the manifestation of the Lord in the atmosphere, just like Jesus says, the sign of the Son of Man. And then there's turmoil begins to happen. And every chapter 6, chapter 8, chapter 11, chapter 16, there's always an earthquake and a shaking taking place, which would be some kind of a theophany of the Lord in Revelation. Chapter 11 is where the two witnesses are killed. They lay in the streets for 3 days, and then they're resurrected and go up into heaven. But there's a great earthquake that takes place at that time. Okay, chapter 14 of Zechariah, we'll read this. And we're done. This plays into this Isaiah 63 somehow, Revelation 19. But again, it sums up the coming of the Lord. Here it is. Chapter 14, verse 1. Now, this has not happened. We talk about the fall of Jerusalem in 586 or the fall of Jerusalem in 70 A.D. Or the Maccabean revolt. This hasn't happened yet. So this is a day in the future. Chapter 14, verse 1, a day of the Lord is coming when your plunder will be divided among you. People of Jerusalem, your plunder will be divided. They're taking your plunder and taking it with them. God says, I will gather all the nations to Jerusalem to fight against it. So this is before he comes to judge the nations and splatter their blood. They are confident that God is not going to do anything, so they are attacking Jerusalem. And again, it's not 586, because that's already happened by the time Zechariah writes. It's not 70 A.D., although preterists would like to teach it that way. Anyway, when they come to fight against Jerusalem on that day, the city will be captured, the houses ransacked, and the women raped. Half the city will go into exile. So they're already leading people out in chains. Half the people are already on their way to the slave market. But the rest of the people will not be taken from the city. Why? What happens? Now, look how far God lets it go. I mean, you were waiting for a buzzer shot. I mean, the place is devastated. They're already taking captives. They're just trying to circle up the last half of the captives. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations as he fights in the day of battle. On that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives. So this is not him fighting through the Babylonians or him fighting some other. This is him coming to the Mount of Olives. And you got to tie this directly in. You don't have to, but you should actually consider in Acts when Jesus was on the Mount of Olives and ascended and the disciples stood there staring and they just got done asking him, are you going to restore Israel of the kingdom to Israel. He says, it's not for you to know the times or seasons. We're going to do something different. Go back to Jerusalem and wait. And then as they looked at him going to heaven, the angels came and says, this same Jesus you saw go into heaven, they say, the angel said, will come back the same way he left. So he was standing in a resurrected body on Mount Zion, and he ascended into the clouds. Daniel even says he saw the Son of Man coming in the clouds of glory. Well, he was on Mount Olive in a physical resurrected body and ascended into the clouds. And he says he'll come back, the same Jesus will come back the same way he left. We'll just reverse the video. You got Jesus in the clouds. Now he's coming back through the clouds to the Mount of Olives. And Zechariah confirms that interpretation. On that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives east of Jerusalem. And again, Mount of Olives can't be figurized. Well, what does Mount of Olives mean? Well, it's east of Jerusalem. It means the Mount of Olives on the other side of the Kidron Valley. And the Mount, watch this, and when he comes, and the Mount of Olives will be split in two, forming from the east to the west. So when he comes back, he's coming down, the mountains start splitting again, forming a great valley. So it splits and a valley is left behind, with half the mountain moving north, half the mountain moving south. You will flee by my mountain valley, for it will extend to Azel, going down south several miles. So in other words, when its Mount of Olives splits, it opens up a valley for all the other, the extra half that hadn't been captured. They'll run out the backside of the city through this brand new escape route. You will flee as you did from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. And that would be something they remember that's recorded in the scriptures. Then the Lord my God, then Yahweh my God will come and all the holy ones with him. Now, are the holy ones angels? Most likely. Do they include the saints? Possible. On that day, there'll be no light, no cold or frost. It will be a unique day without daytime or nighttime, a day known only to the Lord. When evening comes, there will be light. On that day, living water will flow from Jerusalem half to the eastern sea. That would be the Dead Sea, half to the Western Sea, that's the Mediterranean Sea, in summer and in winter. In other words, there's water now coming. This goes back to Ezekiel. There's water coming out of the temple that forms a river that connects the Mediterranean Sea to the Dead Sea. And so water flows through Jerusalem, down, filling up the Dead Sea, and it goes, it's no longer dead. It flows out the bottom of the Dead Sea, down to the Gulf of Aqaba. And then Ezekiel picks this up and talks about there'll be fishing in the Dead Sea. There'll be fishermen on the shores of the Dead Sea catching fish that are the same as the fish in the Mediterranean Sea, which makes sense because they're all connected. But Jerusalem, it says, verse 10, the whole land from Geba to Rimmon, that's the north, Rimmon in the south of Jerusalem, will become like the Arabah, which means flat. But Jerusalem will be raised up and remain in its place. It's not going to be just a temporary, an unstable mountain. It's going to be raised up and stay there. From the Benjamin Gate, then it gives other details about the city. It will be inhabited, never to be destroyed. So that appears to be right there setting up, you know, the millennial kingdom and the kingdom of God. I do want to read those Revelation verses just so you can see more earthquakes and the Lord appearing and make a connection. I think, again, my whole point is I think Habakkuk is seeing, anticipate his prayer after having heard the report, disaster's coming. You're going to have to wait for my intervention. But if you stay faithful, patience, endurance, it will come. And so Habakkuk accepts the fate of the nation and looks forward to the day, when same thing we're looking forward to, the day the Lord returns and sets up his kingdom. Chapter 3, verse 7 talks about the nations, and then we're going to pick this up in chapter 3, verse 8 next week and continue going through it. I will pray. If you have any questions or comments, corrections are always welcome. Well, not always welcome, but are highly needed, highly needed. Corrections are needed. They may not be welcome, but they would be needed. We want the truth, not just my opinion. Father, do thank you again for the opportunity to look into these things. We thank you for your word. We thank you for the freedom we have in Christ, and ask that we would use it to glorify you and live a life that is pleasing to you. We ask that we would have the ability to have faith and patience in difficult times and not be looking to the nations for our hope or looking to anything in this age to deliver us, but be serving as faithful servants at this time in history, looking forward to the true deliverance through Jesus Christ. And in his name we pray. Amen. Thank you again for your patience and your time.